That's 35 in Portsmouth and 32 in Conway.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange.
Good morning, sir.
Tell me, what day is it?
What day? What? It's Christmas Day, Costa.
Christmas Day. Then I haven't missed it. The spirits must have done everything in one night. But of course, they can do anything, can't they? Of course they can.
It's ironic that one of the greatest holiday stories of all time, A Christmas Carol, a tale that warned about greed, selfishness, and one man's utter contempt for the true spirit of the holidays, was written for need of money. Charles Dickens, a journalist, actor, and writer with already a few successful books under his belt, had a fifth child on the way and figured that a quick story about Christmas would make him some quick cash. And so he wrote A Christmas Carol in only 6 weeks, but after quarrels with his publishers, the Christmas spirit prevailed, as it does in the book. Dickens paid for the production costs himself, which included a lavish gold stamp cover and hand-colored etchings. He then sold the book for a low price. It flew off the shelves, and his story, A Christmas Carol, became legend. The tale of Scrooge, the Cratchits, Tiny Tim, and a host of visiting ghosts has become a timeless Christmas tradition, in part because of the lessons of stinginess and scrooginess, and in part because of the pictures it paints of family, frivolity, and true feelings of Christmas, the sights, the smells, and the sounds.
Bravo! Bravo! Come on, everybody now! Everybody!
Gerald Charles Dickens is the author's great-great-grandson, and for the last 10 years, he's come to America to perform his namesake's work during the holiday season. It's a one-man show with 26 different, distinct voices that, just like the Christmas tale, make you laugh one minute, tear up the next, and feel terrified after that. Dickens' one-man show traveled to the Granite State shortly after Thanksgiving this year, and when it did, we caught up with him to learn more about his show, the story, and the legend of his great-great-grandfather. Gerald Charles Dickens, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, my great pleasure.
They called your great-great-grandfather the man who invented Christmas. Now, how come?
Wow. That's quite an accolade. He wrote an idea or an ideal of Christmas that people at that time in the Victorian era really wanted to adhere to. So Charles Dickens presented the perfect Christmas. All of the family together, all of the family enjoying each other's company, great celebrations, wonderful feasts, wonderful food. But at the heart of it, it was that family gathering. And people adored that. There's a very famous story in London. A little girl, on hearing of the death of Charles Dickens, went to her father and said, "Is Father Christmas dead too?" Because she so associated Charles Dickens with Christmas. He, at heart, was a reporter. He was a journalist. That was his background, long before he started writing. His early career was in journalism. So he had a great eye for observation. And that, allied to his ability to communicate that, was wonderful. And at that time in England, Christmas was changing.
Yeah, what was going on around that time?
Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, was bringing in the Germanic Christmas celebrations. He'd introduced the first Christmas tree into England, and that the very first Christmas card was actually published in the same year A Christmas Carol was published. So it was becoming a much bigger celebration. Up to that point, it had been quite a quiet, almost, I suppose, a bit like Thanksgiving here, which I love the Thanksgiving holiday because it isn't commercialized. It's very much a family holiday, and that's what Christmas was before. But with Prince Albert bringing his German background influences into it, it suddenly started growing, and people started giving gifts and having these big feasts and these wonderful celebrations. And Dickens just saw that and reported it, if you like. I mean, reported it in a fantastic way, but reported it nonetheless.
A very positive way.
Yeah,
he loved
a very positive way. And people just really took to that. And suddenly, as I said at the beginning, this was the ideal of Christmas. This was the Christmas we are going to aspire to. We're going to celebrate like that. So he didn't exactly invent it. You couldn't quite claim that. But he certainly popularized it at that time.
He was the right person at the right time. You know, in rereading the book, which I just did, I was struck by the descriptions of Christmas. You know, the food and the cookies and the dancing and the drinking, and even the children drink, by the way. Could you do for us, please, Gerald, a piece from the book where you just get a sense of the general merriment of people.
Wow,
there's Fezziwig's party,
there's
the Cratchit party.
That's exactly
Why
what
don't
I was
you do that
say,
one for
because,
us?
Because that is wonderful. And right from the very first description of Fezziwig, he's a huge, jolly, vibrant man, and his wife is described as a one vast, substantial smile, so, which I think is a gorgeous description. So Scrooge is with the Ghost of Christmas Present. They arrive in front of the warehouse
Christmas
door.
Christmas past, right?
Oh,
he
Christmas
was with Fezziwig in the past.
Pardon, of course. Sorry, who wrote this book? with the Ghost of Christmas. And they arrive at the warehouse door, and Scrooge, he suddenly realises where he is and says, but Spirit, I was apprenticed here. They went in, and at sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig, sitting at such a high desk that if he'd been 2 inches taller, he surely would have hit his head against the ceiling, Scrooge cried with great excitement, "Why? Why, it's Fezziwig, alive again!" "Yo-ho, my boys! Ebenezer, Dick!" Scrooge's former self came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow apprentice. That was Dick Wilkins, to be sure. He was very attached to me, was Dick. "Oh, dear, dear. Yo-ho, my boys, no more work tonight. It's Christmas Eve, Dick. It's Christmas, Ebenezer. Now let's have this place cleared away before a man could say, Jack Robinson!" Clear away. There is nothing they wouldn't have cleared away or couldn't have cleared away with Fezziwig looking on. And the warehouse was as dry and bright and snug a ballroom as you could wish to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler, went up to a lofty desk, made an orchestra of it, and tuned like 50 stomachaches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig. One vast, substantial smile. In came the three Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came the six young followers whose hearts they broke. In they all came anyhow and everyhow. There were dances, there were forfeits, there were more dances. There was a great piece of cold roast, a great piece of cold boiled. There were mince pies and plenty of beer. Ooh, I'm hungry now.
It makes me want to be there. You know, the descriptions
just
are just incredible.
Cheerful feeling to the whole idea of it. And as you say, you just want to be in it. So that was his great talent in all of his novels. He just pulled his readers into the story, into the very heart of it.
Well, another thing that I was struck by all the descriptions in the book of these wonderful Christmases that you just want to be in is that they're all so focused on family, on neighbors, on relatives. Just a couple mentions of religion, but it's not a big part of it.
No, it's not. And I think that's one of the reasons that A Christmas Carol is still so popular today, because it is a story that gets to the very heart of the, as I said earlier, the ideal of Christmas without becoming denominational. It doesn't tie it into a specific religion or creed or race or anything else. And I think actually that's one of the reasons it's so popular in the United States, because it just covers the whole nation, the wonderful diverse nation, and everyone can sort of tap into that idea of Christmas. And I'm sure that was a very conscious decision on his part when he was writing it to not make it specifically. And it also harks back to the Christmas that was celebrated before, that although it's becoming a Christian festival and developing that way, it had been before almost quite pagan, quite purely to the family. So I'm sure he was trying to marry the two parts of Christmas together, the new sort of brash, big, fun, exciting Christmas to the original idea of a very friendly, tight family community Christmas.
Speaking of families, what was your great-great-grandfather's own family life like?
As a child or him as a father?
Yes.
He had a very, very difficult upbringing. His father, if you know your Dickens novels, was personified in the character of Mr. Micawber in David Copperfield. He wasn't a good businessman. He couldn't look after his finances. He always wanted to entertain. He wasn't a bad man by any statement, quite the opposite. He was a wonderful, generous man. But he always wanted to entertain and always entertained a little above his means. So the family were always in terrible debt. And in fact, Charles's father was sent to debtor's prison in London. And at that time, it wasn't just you that was sent to debtor's prison. Your wife was sent to debtor's prison. All your family was sent to debtor's prison. Most of your furniture was put in with you. Even your servants, if you had any, were all sent in with you. So actually, it wasn't too bad a deal because the only person that wasn't in prison with you was your creditors, which is fine. But obviously, the disgrace in society was terrible. And to relieve the debt, one member of the family had to be let out of prison to go and work. And it was Charles, aged 12. He was sent to work in a terrible, squalid, horrible, dark, rat-infested, smelly, terrible factory in London. And he hated it, absolutely hated it. And he saw, at that time in his life, the lowest of the low of society in London. He saw them all on the streets. He saw the criminals. He saw the robbers. He saw the people that had absolutely no hope at all. And that's why in a number of his novels, he's always championing the cause of the underdog, because he'd been there. He'd suffered. He'd seen it. And also why that when he could, he made sure that life was comfortable and fun and wonderful, because it was very, very important to him. He'd seen the other side of it.
So was his family the Cratchit family?
I think one of the special things I think about A Christmas Carol is he wrote it almost as an everyman story. So we can all see ourselves in every character. So I think we're all the Cratchit family. We all feel a little undervalued at Christmas. We all want to spend more time with the family. We all want a little more so we can have a slightly better Christmas feast or vacation or whatever it might be. But on the flip side to that, we're also all Scrooge. We've all also got a bit of Scrooge in us. We all get completely fed up come Christmas Eve when we've still got 17 gifts to buy and the mall is packed and you can't get into the parking lot and someone's rattling a charity chin under your nose and you go, please take it all away, I don't want to do this. So, and of course at the end of the novel, everyone reconciles that the Cratchit family is valued and they do have their feast and they've given this wonderful turkey, and Scrooge comes the other way. He realises the importance of friendship and family and being generous. So I don't think you can actually tie the Cratchit family specifically down to him. I think he wanted to give us a view of our own personality in as many different ways as possible.
Give us that bit from the book, Gerald, please, where it's the Ghost of Christmas Present, Scrooge is viewing the Cratchits' humble Christmas, mm-hmm. and you get a sense of exactly what you just talked about, that they're happy and they're doing their best, but gee, they wish they had a little more time and just a little bit more of a feast.
It's a lovely passage, and then Scrooge comes along and the spirit led him through the city streets to Bob Cratchit's dwelling. And there the Ghost of Christmas Present blessed his four-roomed house. Up rose Mrs. Cratchit, saying, whatever's got into your precious father, then? He weren't as late last year by half an hour. And Tiny Tim, and as the words were spoken, in came little Bob with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy hissing hot. Master Peter Cratchit mashed up the potatoes with incredible vigour. Miss Belinda Cratchit sweetened up the applesauce. And at last the cloth was laid and grace was said. And it was succeeded by a breathless pause as Mrs. Cratchit looked all along the carving knife and prepared to plunge it into the breast. But when she did, and when that long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose around the whole table. There never was such a goose. Bob Cratchit said there never was such a goose cooked. And, eked out by the applesauce and the mashed potato, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family.
There's the sense of it, then.
Yeah.
Eked out by the applesauce.
It was sufficient.
Just enough.
And later, Mrs. Cratchit goes on, she spies a little bone on one of the plates and says, look, we haven't even finished it all. There's a little left over.
Unlike usual dinners, where
exactly.
they probably devour every
exactly.
single morsel. You also talked about just how Charles Dickens, your great-great-grandfather, saw everything in the streets, mm-hmm. lived a very hard life himself as a young man. Very difficult, but made him a great writer in the end. There's a political message about that in this book. Take care of the poor. They are you. There's one great line, and you don't need to do the whole thing, but help me with the line. It's something like, at Christmas, we all realize that we are all equal travelers to the grave, something like that.
Yes, it's nephew Fred's bit at the beginning. He's trying to convince Scrooge to come and visit him on Christmas Eve, and Scrooge has said, bah, humbug, you know, Christmas out upon Merry Christmas. Christmas And actually, Scrooge has a perfectly valid message. He's saying, you know, what is Christmas time to you? You just spend a load more money. I mean, what's the point? And Fred, yes, he says that Christmas time to me has always been the one time in the whole year when we really do see other people below us as if they were fellow passengers to the grave and not another race of people bound on other journeys. It's a nice little line. And the political point, Charles Dickens, as I mentioned earlier, his background was journalism, and the specific journalism he did was to work in the House of Commons, recording all of the parliamentary speeches and debates. And there was no scope for any imagination there, because he just had to write down exactly what all the politicians said. And he couldn't believe it, because he listened to these wealthy, respectable, pompous politicians, and they didn't know and they didn't care, and they were just self-serving as far as he could see. So as soon as he had this platform for him to be able to dispel his message, he banged it away in all of his books, not just Christmas Carol. They all have that same theme at their very heart, that everybody is equal. And normally his very first novel, The Pickwick Papers, the central characters are just rich, respectable gentlemen going on travels, and he just pokes fun at them. He says, "You're just stupid. Look at yourselves. Have you no idea how ridiculous you are?"
Well, how open was the public at that time to that message of, hey, everybody's equal?
Well, the public who up to that point had been reading novels were not open to it at all, because they were the wealthy, respectable ones. And of course, a novel at that time was a major, major outlay. It was bound in leather, it had gold leaf on the cover, you put it in your library, you probably never read it again. Now, what Dickens did was made sure his novels were published in a serial form, monthly, so they were very cheap to produce. They were only bound in paper, that they weren't hardcovers, that they were little more than cheap magazines, or even pamphlets, if you like. So suddenly, the readership absolutely swelled, because they could afford it.
Mass production.
And this new readership, the lower income readership, suddenly thought, well, thank heavens, there is somebody championing our cause. There is someone who knows about us. And that was the thing. It wasn't a wealthy author sort of looking at them pretending he knew. He did know. And, right. And they could see that through the writing, that they understood that he was one of them and fighting on their behalf.
So, although that business model caused him some trouble with A Christmas Carol, right, Gerald?
He was always in having arguments with his publishers. When Charles wrote A Christmas Carol, and the strange thing is, when he started to write it, he wrote it purely because he needed cash. The novel he was writing, which was Martin Chuzzlewit, wasn't selling desperately well. And so he thought, well, I know, I'll write a nice little short Christmas book. It'll sell well. It'll make me lots of income. That'll be great. But how could Christmas Carol ever be written just for financial gain? Please. But as he wrote it, he realized how special this was going to be. And he thought, I've got to make this a very special book. So it had huge production values. It was beautifully bound. It was written in one volume. It wasn't a monthly one. Beautifully bound, hand-tinted watercolor pictures, gold edges to the pages, everything. But it was still sold very cheap, because he wanted all his readership to be able to afford it. And in fact, he made very, very little on it at all. But he was desperate to almost give it as a Christmas gift to his readers.
So he started out saying, I want to make a lot of money on this. I have a child on the way. And in the end, he said no.
No, exactly.
How about you, Gerald? You come over here a lot, right?
It's my 10th year touring United States, yes. I get a little further afield.
What are the audiences looking for from you, do you think?
Oh, I really don't know. Christmas Carol over here, and it really, really struck me the very first time I came, is a much bigger phenomenon in the United States than it is in England. It captures people. Everybody has their own tradition for A Christmas Carol, that they will all get their favorite movie version out and sit down and watch it, that they will sit around and the grandfather of the family will read it to the family on Christmas Eve. And everybody hangs their Christmas on this ideal of A Christmas Carol. And it's lovely to be able to perform, because people know the story, so they're in it with you. I haven't got to tell them the story. I haven't got to worry about, do they understand the plot? Do they realize that this is in the past, this is in the present, this is in the future? Because everybody knows it, and they're in the story with you. And the way I perform it is very simple. I really have no set at all. I just have a chair and a hat stand and maybe a table, and that's it. So people's imaginations can work for themselves and build the sets and build the scene and build the street and build the Cratchit's house for themselves. And it's lovely, because you can see people immersing themselves in the story. It's so nice.
Of the 10 years that you've been performing this in the United States, before probably hundreds of American audiences, what scene, Gerald, do you think sort of grabs your Americans the most?
Oh.
And could you do that for us, please?
Well, I think the one that probably stirs your emotions the most, I don't know if it'll actually make very good radio because there's lots of silence in it, but it's when, with A Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, Scrooge is visiting the Cratchits' house. And I've never really overplayed the character of Tiny Tim. He says God blesses everyone once. And to me, the tragedy of it is not Tiny Tim, it is Bob's loss, Bob Cratchit's loss.
Go ahead and do it. It's so we can difficult. Deal with the silence. Okay. This is public radio.
Spirit led Scrooge to Bob Cratchit's dwelling. It was quiet. It was very quiet. In came little Bob, alone. Mrs. Cratchit rushed to see him. You went today then, Robert? Yes, my dear. Yes, I went today. I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. But you will see it often. Because I promised him. I promised him that we would walk there on a Sunday. Oh, my little child. My little, little child. Bob Cratchit broke down all at once. He couldn't help it. If he could have helped it, he and his son would have been farther apart, perhaps, than they were. Oh, Tim. Oh, Tiny Tim. God bless you. There we are.
We'll take a short break.
Good.
More with Gerald Charles Dickens and A Christmas Carol after a short break. I'm Laura Canoy. You're listening to a special holiday exchange on NHPR. Next week on The Exchange, we play back for you our earlier series on New Hampshire's immigration story. We'll examine the long history of newcomers in our state up to the issues surrounding immigration today. We'll also look back at the year 2011 with our annual Newsmakers of the Year program, exploring what happened in the economy, politics, the legislature, the Occupy movement, and some extreme weather. Join us all next week for The Exchange, each morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from St. Mary's Bank, the nation's first credit union, helping New Hampshire families and businesses grow and prosper for over 100 years. Season's greetings from St. Mary's Bank. From the Common Man family of restaurants providing holiday cheer for office parties or holiday events at your location or theirs, information at the Seaman. mfromfishandgame.com under Groups and Functions. M from New Hampshire Fish and Game and its nonprofit partner for the Wildlife Heritage Foundation of New Hampshire, thanking you for sharing your land with hunters and anglers. New Hampshire weather for today, cloudy, snow-ending, accumulations 1 to 2 inches, highs 30 to 35 for most of the state, around 40 in southern sections of the state. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, a low near 10 above across the North Country, 15 in central parts of the state, and near 20 in southern New Hampshire. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, some breaks of sunshine with highs from 25 north, ranging to around 35 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
I'm Laura Kanoy. This is The Exchange. We're broadcasting a special holiday program today on A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. This classic Christmas tale has endured the test of time, both for its images of Christmas celebrations and lessons of what happens when greed and scrooginess get in the way. Last month, we caught up with Gerald Charles Dickens, the great-great-grandson of the famous author Charles Dickens. Gerald's one-man show, A Christmas Carol, has toured in this country for 10 years. We spoke with him about this timeless tale, the man who wrote it, and the great-great-grandson who's helping to keep it alive. Gerald, let's talk about you for a little while. We've talked a lot about your great-great-grandfather and Christmas Carol. First of all, the show itself, You go around, do you perform the whole book, word for word? What do you do?
Not the whole book. It's edited down quite a bit. If I was to perform the whole book, the show would be about 3 hours long and with the greatest will in the world. So it's edited down to about an hour 15. And in fact, the version I originally took when I started doing it was the version that Dickens himself had edited down for his readings. He had decided that the book was too long to do all at once, so he edited it down. So I took that as my starting point. I've worked on it over the years and put some things back in that he had taken out and taken some things out that he had left in. Really made it my own show that works on stage. How do you describe it? It's what I would call a one-man dramatization of the book. It's not a reading. It's not static. It's not done from a lectern or a podium. I move about on the stage. All of the characters have their own voices, facial expressions, ways of standing, ways of moving. So visually to the audience, it's very apparent who is speaking and what their role in the story is. So that's how I've developed it over the years. I never really sat down and designed it or directed it. It's all come out of improvisation. In fact, originally it was a reading. It started off as a reading, and I had all the voices.
So you're saying your great-great-grandfather did this too, then?
Oh, yeah. That's what he did when he came over on his second tour.
So he was an actor too?
That's what he wanted to do. He loved to do that. His greatest passion was theatre. He wanted to be an actor long before he ever became a writer. Yeah. The theatre was his background, very much.
Did that work for him financially,
yes,
to act these things
very
out?
Very much.
Really?
Very much.
See, I didn't know that.
In fact, at the end of his life, he was almost as popular for his theatrical performances of his works, and he did them from all sorts of books, as he was for his novels. He was the hot ticket in town. If he came to Broadway or the big city, you would have to be there, and you'd be at the front of the line, and the lines would go round and round city blocks waiting to get tickets. Yeah, he was a big draw.
How do you come up with the voices, Gerald? Because there's a lot of characters in here, from Mr. Fezziwig to the spirits to Tiny Tim.
It started very much as, when it began as a reading, it was almost like designing an audio version of it, because I couldn't move about when you've had a book and a lectern. So I had to make all the voices very, very distinct. Well, the main voice, obviously, is the one of Scrooge that is the centre to the whole story. So I had to begin with that. Now, the very first description we get of Scrooge in the book is, oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. And you just can't help saying that without, I mean, I've done it now in the studio, around your shoulders, you clench your hands up and you get this grating in your voice. And then later in the same description, it says his voice was grating, it spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. So everything has got to be harsh. He's running a business in London, so it's a London accent. It's not Cockney, because that's kind of the working-class London accent. Everything about Scrooge is harsh, it's vicious, it's direct, it's to the point. It's Christmas, out upon Merry Christmas. What is Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills with no money? Time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer. It's all that. It's almost like a machine gun. So then to compare against that, all the other voices have to spring off from that central point. So Cratchit, for instance, I wanted him to be very soft and lyrical and slightly musical, to be the complete antithesis of the Scrooge voice. So I decided to go for dialect, for different regional accents in England. Now, as small as England is compared to the United States, the diversity of regional accents in England is absolutely huge, so I've got plenty to choose from. So originally I was going to make Cratchit Welsh, because the Welsh accent is a beautiful lyrical accent, and it goes up and down, and it's soft, and it's gentle, and it's lovely. But I very quickly discovered I couldn't do it for very long. Then it goes drifting off all around the world. I end up in sort of India or Pakistan or somewhere. So I abandoned Welsh. And instead, I gave him West Country accent, a Cornish accent, which, again, is very soft. It's slightly vulnerable, if you like. But by sort of putting a slight kind of stammer in his voice all the time. You know, so he's like that. He plucks up his courage to ask Scrooge. Scrooge asks him, in fact, knowing full well what the answer's going to be. He says, you'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose. He's asking him on Christmas Eve. Oh, well, if it is quite convenient, sir. It's not convenient. It's not fair. You'd think yourself ill-used if I were to stop you half a crown for it. Well, it is only once a year, sir. And so by having these two very different voices, you can cut out all the said Scrooge answer the clerk sort of linking lines, because it's just, you know who it is. And then going through the nephew is cheerful and he's positive and he's fun and everybody likes him and he's probably very good looking, so I just gave him my voice. That seemed sensible.
Do a little bit of the nephew and his wife, because they're some of my favorite characters. The nephew saying, oh, don't hate Uncle Scrooge.
Yeah,
I feel sorry for him. And she's saying, you know, he's an old stinker.
The big party, and Scrooge is suddenly taken there. And in fact, he's come straight there from Bob Cratchit. And it was a great surprise to Scrooge to hear a hearty laugh. It was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognise it as his own nephew's. He said that Christmas was a humbug, as I live. He meant it too. Well, more shame on him, Fred, said Scrooge's niece by marriage indignantly. Bless these women. They're always in earnest. They never do anything by halves. Oh, I feel sorry for him. So he takes it into his head to dislike us. So what does he lose? He don't miss much of a dinner, I think. On the contrary, Fred, I think he misses a very good dinner indeed. Well, I'm pleased to hear it, for I have no great faith in these modern housekeepers. What do you say, Topper? And off they go into their party and they start playing games and everything else.
I love the women in this book. They always say what they think.
They do. They do.
They don't cut Scrooge any slack
whatsoever.
No,
they don't. No, Mrs. Cratchit's the same. She says, I'm not toasting Scrooge today.
The spirits. How hard or easy is it to get into their voices? I mean, who's heard a spirit talk, really? So.
Well, exactly. That's very true. The Ghost of Christmas Past is a very difficult one because you have no idea what he, she, it is.
Exactly.
The description of he, she, it says it's old, it's young. It has 20 arms, it has one arm. It doesn't have a head, it has a head. It's tall, it's small. The only thing you know about it has a huge jet of light coming out from its head. So what on earth is it? So I gave it quite an ethereal, sort of floaty, gossamer kind of voice, which is fairly monotone, so it needs to be slightly menacing but not threatening. It's a strange one.
Do a little bit for us, Gerald.
What are you?
I am the Ghost of Christmas Past.
Long past?
No, your past. The things that you shall see with me are shadows of things that have been. They will have no consciousness of us. Rise, Ebenezer, walk with me.
They passed through the wall, and Scrooge stood on an open country road with snow upon the ground. But I was born here. I was raised in this place.
Do you recollect the way?
Remember it? I could walk it blindfold.
Strange that you have forgotten it for so many years.
So it's sort of just a constant. It's always there. Whatever Scrooge does, whatever he sees, whether he's happy, whether he's sad, whether he's excited, whether he's terrified, that constant is always there, just on one monotone level, floating on. He can't do anything about it because you can't change the past. That's the kind of idea behind that one. The Ghost of Christmas Present.
That's a little easier, isn't
it?
Yeah. A little more approachable.
Yeah. Again, I went regional with that and used an accent from the north of England, from the county of Yorkshire, where, you know, up in Yorkshire, people are right down to earth and they say what's what and they call a spade and that's what it's going to be. So that's where the Ghost of Christmas Present comes. He's a big, bluff Yorkshireman. So Scrooge went and sat upon this throne. Was a jolly giant, glorious to behold, who held in his hand a torch and held it up high up to shed its light upon Scrooge as he came peeping round the door. It was clothed in a green robe, and this garment was open, so his capacious breast was bare. His hair was long and free, free as its sparkling eye, its open hand, its cheery voice, its unconstrained demeanour.
Look upon me. I am the ghost of Christmas present. You have not seen the like of me before. So he's jolly and he's fun and he's big and he's brash. And yet suddenly, he's terrifying. Because when they're at the Cratchits' Christmas lunch, and Tiny Tim says, God bless us, everyone. And Scrooge turns, and Dickens uses a phrase which, funny enough, he used in another story that he'd written a few years before, but it's exactly the same phrase. He says, "Spirit," said Scrooge, with an interest he had never felt before. "Tell me. Tell me if Tiny Tim will live." "What? I see an empty seat in the poor chimney corner, and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved." "No. No, Spirit, say that he will be spared."
"If the shadows remain unaltered by the future, the boy will die." "But what of that? If he be like to die, then perhaps he had better do it and decrease the surplus population, eh, Ebenezer Scrooge?"
So suddenly you've got that bluff, fun, but...
Right. Geez. Throwing Scrooge's own words right back at him.
Throwing him straight back at him. And then later with the two children, Ignorance and Want, as the spirit is about to die because they've reached the end of the day. And, of course, the idea is that each spirit takes Scrooge on a journey for one day and that the spirit is very aged, and suddenly he brings these awful skeletal figures out from beneath his robe, and Scrooge is horrified by them. He says, "That's a spirit. The children, are they yours?" And the spirit replies, "They are man's, but they cling to me. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both. But most of all, beware this boy, for on his brow I see written that which is doom. Have they no refuge? Have they no resource? Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?" And then he's gone.
And those are Scrooge's words again. That's what Scrooge says in the early in the book.
He keeps pushing this down. And just as Scrooge is getting into the fun and the joyousness of a Christmas day today, suddenly, boom, the spirit takes it all from him again. He's a great character. He's really good.
There's that political message again,
exactly,
too. Want
exactly.
And ignorance.
Ignorance and want. And beware ignorance more than anything.
Yeah, what is... Could you describe that a little bit more? Why ignorance more than want?
Because want is always there. Want is what the poor need. You know, that's what they're crying out for. Ignorance is just us ignoring it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
and
what
doing nothing about it.
And that's what I mentioned earlier about him in the House of Parliament. He just saw the ignorance because people didn't want to know about it and they certainly didn't care about it. So he's saying if you can do something about the want, you can look after that. You can treat that as long as you do something. But ignorance of the situation is not doing anything. And that's the biggest crime, is the ignorance of the situation.
Just a little bit more, Gerald, if you could, on the spirits. The ghost of Christmas future. That's probably pretty easy to do.
That's quite easy to do on the radio.
He stands there and points.
He just points a lot. Yeah. But he's a menace.
He doesn't say anything.
He doesn't say anything. He's a menacing creature.
I remember being terrified of him as a child.
You are. And the first description of him says, "The ghost of Christmas present has gone," after that last line, that the clock struck 12. And Scrooge is looking about for the ghost of Christmas present and can't see him anywhere. And as the clock finishes striking 12, he remembers the original prediction that Jacob Marley had made him. And lifting up his eyes, he beheld a solemn phantom, draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground towards him. It was clothed in a black robe that concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. And you never hear anything of the ghost. It just points, and occasionally it inclines its head, if it has one. Dickens describes the folds of its robe looking as if it might be inclining its head in a nod. And that's the only thing it does. And yet, I love that description, coming like a mist. It's just born. It doesn't walk. It doesn't travel. It just is there, rolling in. And if you see a mist coming in, it's inexorable. It's coming towards you. You can't do anything about it. So whereas for the Ghost of Christmas Past, you couldn't change the past, Scrooge's future is coming, rolling in towards him, and he can't do anything about it unless he changes his ways. So the Ghost of Christmas Past is, you're right, terrifying.
I had nightmares even
about
it,
sure.
I think,
and the things he shows Scrooge are just horrific. I mean, we had the passage earlier of Cratchit and mourning the loss of Tiny Tim. But also, he takes him to a horrible place in London, a shop where they sell old clothes and bones, and it is vile description. I mean, the one I use on the show is very mild compared to the full description Dickens gives in the book, which is absolutely horrendous. Which, after all of the fun and the jollity and the smiles and the laughter and the singing and everything else, you suddenly got this horrific description of London life. And you sit back and you think, wow. And yet, of course, the ghost has no compunction about taking Scrooge there at all.
Charles Dickens had no compunction about taking us there.
Us there, exactly.
You know, one more ghost that we haven't talked about is Jacob Marley.
Yeah, Scrooge's old partner.
The one who starts it all.
Marley was dead to begin with. What a great start to a book. Isn't that the best opening line to any book? Marley was dead to begin with. You know exactly where you are. Now, the voice for Marley, that was quite difficult because he has to be terrifying. He has to terrify Scrooge, but he also has to be a real person. Scrooge has to recognize him as his own partner. So he sort of has Scrooge's, a very similar voice to Scrooge.
Because he was a nasty old guy, too.
A nasty old guy, too. And yet, Dickens describes the ghost as having a bandage that holds its jaw together. And this was sort of almost a way of embalming at that time. You bound a corpse's jaw up together. And Dickens says that there's one horrible time where he takes the bandage off and his jaw just drops straight down. Bearing that in mind, I sort of gave him a voice a bit like Scrooge's, but then sort of giving him a slight sort of dental impediment. You know? It's the best way to put it. So he can't quite pronounce his words properly. As the ghost comes in and Scrooge sees him and says,
Well, what do you want with me? Much?
It was Marley's voice. There was no doubt about that.
Oh, what are you?
In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley.
Jacob? Jacob, you are fettered. Tell me why.
I wear the chain I forged in life, Ebenezer Scrooge. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it of my own free will, and of my own free will I wear it.
And the other thing about Jacob Marley's character is that he's described as always having to travel, always having to move, to go through life and to see what he can't share in now, but he could have shared in life, but didn't. So all the time he's on stage, he's moving backwards and forwards. That hand is going here, is going there. Scrooge is terrified, rigid in his chair. Marley is always moving, always pulling this heavy chain with him, swinging along. He never stops. He's actually an exhausting character. Just give it a rest. Just sit down.
Well, in all the years that you've been doing this, Gerald, all the work that you've done and all the performances, what have you learned about your great-great-grandfather in doing this?
He was a very good scriptwriter.
Mm-hmm. We can see that.
Yeah, I'll give him that. The energy, I think. The sense of theatricality. The knowing exactly what it took to construct a wonderful story. It's not just the writing. It's not the words and the sentences. It's the construction of it that is so clever. That he takes you on a journey, and one minute you're high, next minute you're low. One minute you're elated, one minute you're terrified. And he pulls and he manipulates his readership, and now, through me, his audiences, in all sorts of different ways. I mean, that passage we did of Cratchit crying over Tiny Tim, I defy anyone not to be moved by that passage. And yet, just a few seconds before, we've been laughing at something completely different. And later, we'll be absolutely, a few seconds later, we'll be terrified in the churchyard as Scrooge suddenly realizes that this is where his life is taking him. And then a few minutes after that, we will be leaping around and excited on Christmas morning. He so wonderfully constructed the piece. I think that's what impresses me and affects me most of all, is his ability to put together this story. I think it's a wonderful, and the more I do it, the more wonderful I think it is every year.
Speaking of acting out this story, A Christmas Carol, you are well aware that you're not the only one who does this, obviously. There have been, how many, like a dozen movie versions or something of this?
More, maybe.
Do you watch them? What do you think of these movie versions?
I love Christmas Carol in whatever form it comes. And that's one of the things that is testament to the original story. It is so perfect because whatever you do to it, whoever does it, in whatever format or era, it always works. It always works every time you see it. You're elated at the end. You're terrified during the middle. I mean, Bill Murray's Scrooge, when he played the TV executive, that worked. Mr. Magoo did it. Whoopi Goldberg did it. Jack Palance did a Western version of it. Obviously, there are the traditional ones, the Alistair Sim, George C. Scott, and Patrick Stewart did a new one last year. And Kelsey Grammer did a new one last year as well. All in their own way.
Do you have a favorite?
You know, I love the Muppet version. I adore the Muppets version of A Christmas Carol.
I thought you were going to say, you know, George C. Scott or something.
Well, yeah. George C. Scott is actually one of my favourite Scrooges. I love him as Scrooge. He's played very different to the way most people play it. He plays it big and brash and bold. And when you think about it, Scrooge is running his own financial business in the heart of the city of London, which at that time was the biggest economy in the world. And he's running this business single-handed. He must have been a fantastic businessman.
You know, we talked earlier, Gerald, about how your great-great-grandfather was credited by some with inventing Christmas, you know, making it what it is, the celebrations, the light, the dancing, the food, the wine, and so forth. How is Christmas celebrated in Britain today compared to those marvelous, marvelous descriptions of how it was celebrated, you know, 160 or 70 years ago?
I would say that a Christmas day and a Christmas lunch, it's very specific to an individual family. It's still very much a family day. And forget all the commercialization that goes on from the middle of September up to Christmas. At the very heart of it, Christmas Day itself, I would compare very much to Thanksgiving Day over here. It's very much a family affair. And people come along very traditional. Everything will run along strict, strict guidelines. I remember my childhood Christmases. You woke up in the morning, there's the Christmas stocking, you open that, that's exciting. Now, in my family, we weren't allowed to open the gifts underneath the tree then. And we had to wait, and then we had a big breakfast, which would always be ham and eggs and all sorts of wonderful things. And then we would go to church. It was always very important to go to church on Christmas morning, so we still couldn't open our gifts, and you'd be looking at the tree, and it'd all be there, and you'd find the box that was for you, and you'd rattle it and try and work out what it was, and you still weren't allowed, had to put it back. So then you went to church, and as a kid, you sort of sat there nervously, you know, and fiddling about, and oh, what's the time? Oh, another hymn, here we go. And you do that, and your mum and dad seem very serious, and they're doing that. And then church finishes, and then you gather outside, and then your mother and father have to talk to some people they haven't seen for a year since they were last outside church, and then you're standing there, you want to get home, you get your, when you still can't do that. And then eventually you get home. Now's the time. Nope, still can't go and get the gifts because mum has to put the vegetables on for the, like Mrs. Cratchit, and she has to make sure the pudding's cooking, and then dad starts getting drinks for everyone, and oh, please, and then mum has to get a pad of paper so she can write down who everybody's got presents from, and then at last you can, and then there's just paper everywhere and gifts everywhere and boxes everywhere, and that's absolutely fabulous. And then when all that's over, you go and have lunch, which was turkey and vegetables and potatoes and oh, and the Christmas pudding. Always a tradition to carry the Christmas pudding around the table. And it would be on fire. It'd be covered in brandy or rum or some spirit. And you'd set fire to it and all the lights would be turned out and mum would come in and carry it all around the table. And if she could get it around the table
just
without
like
going
Cratchit.
Out. Just like Mrs. Cratchit. And that all happens. And then the Queen makes an address to the whole country on television at 3 o'clock on Christmas afternoon. So you sit and you very carefully listen to what the Queen has to say, which for a sort of 6-year-old child or whatever it is has no interest at all.
Let me at that train set.
Exactly. And then the afternoon just disappears off and there's movies on. You might go for a walk or, yeah, it's just wonderful. And honestly, that could be any of my childhood Christmases running along exactly the same lines.
And not that different from the Christmases described in A Christmas Carol.
It's not. It really is a very traditional and happy time to be with your family. Yeah.
I'd love to end with you, Gerald, with a performance of that last scene where Scrooge comes alive. And I have to tell you, I was reading this last night about 10:30 or 11 o'clock and just beaming as I read it and just laughing out loud. And it's just terrific. I'd love for you to end with that scene of, again, where Scrooge wakes up and he realizes that he's still alive and that he still has a chance.
Well, he's just been with the ghost of Christmas yet to come, and he's been terrified. He's seen the vision of his own grave, and as he watches, the ghost changes shape in front of him. It's the first time the ghost done anything, and he's watching it. And he says, and as he watched, the spirit shrank collapsed, dwindled down.
No! No, Spirit, no!
Dwindled down into a bedpost. Yes. Yes, the bedpost was his own. The room was his own. But best and happiest of all, the time before him was his own to make amends in. I shall live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. O heaven, and the Christmas time be praised for this. I say it on my knees, Jacob O'Marley, on my knees.
He ran to the window and opened it. No fog, no mist, but clear, bright, shining, golden sunlight.
What's today, my fine fellow?
He called to a young boy who was passing.
Eh? What's today, my fine fellow?
Today? Well, it's Christmas Day, isn't it?
It's Christmas Day. I haven't missed it. I haven't. There's a spirit. The spirits have done it all in one night. Hello, my fine fellow.
Hello?
Do you know the Poulterer shop in the next street but one?
I should hope I did.
An intelligent boy, a remarkable boy. Tell me, do you know if they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one.
What, the one as big as me?
What a remarkable boy. It's a pleasure to talk with him. Yes, my buck, the one as big as you.
Why, it's hanging up there now.
Go and buy it.
Walker!
No, I am in earnest. Go and buy it, and tell the man to bring it back here, and I shall give him the directions where to take it. I shall send it to Bob Cratchit's. Oh, he won't know who sent it. Why, it's twice the size of Tiny Tim. Scrooge got dressed all in his best and went out into the city streets.
And so it goes on. And he's just happy, and he goes and visits Fred, and he goes to the Cratchit's, and
But the lovely bit, actually, he's leaping around. He's, I'm as merry as a schoolboy. I'm as giddy as a drunken man. Whoop, hello, and Merry Christmas to everybody. He's jumping up and down and he's calling, and it's a great thing to do.
Well, I don't know how else to end it but there. And Gerald Charles Dickens, it has been a huge pleasure talking to you.
It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, and a very, very Merry Christmas.
And to you. Very Merry Christmas.
Gerald Charles Dickens is the great-great-grandson of Charles Dickens. His one-man show, A Christmas...